Good morning. We'll pick up where we left off in handout 14. So as I said last time, we're in the home stretch, just coming up to the New Testament era. And we're just pausing to look at a couple of the noteworthy developments during the period right before the opening of the New Testament. So maybe three weeks ago, we looked at the synagogue, the development of the synagogue. And then we were looking at the rise in messianic expectations over the intertestamental period. That's kind of where we left off last time. So we're working off of handout 14. And what we're doing is looking at a survey of the messianic expectations leading up to the New Testament. And so last time we took a look, which was kind of a review of the rise in the interest in apocalyptic themes and apocalyptic literature that had happened over the period. And we looked at some of the examples of the apocalyptic literature and how that connects to the messianic expectations. You might expect that that would be connected when you start having apocalyptic themes, kingdom themes, futuristic themes, judgment. All of that kind of is wrapped in apocalyptic literature. And so you could see how that might be naturally connected to messianic figure that would be coming. And so I think where we got to was the examples of messianic themes in the literature. And so we'll pick up there today. So I guess that's on the back side of your outline is where we're picking up. So examples of messianic themes, I want to take just a quick survey of two different sources for the messianic themes that we find in the intertestamental period. And really, this is just a survey to see what kinds of ideas were out there in terms of what we can find in the literature. Well, it's all coming from literature, obviously, but two different sources, apocalyptic writings, and then we'll look at the Qumran community as well, where we find a lot of these ideas. So those are the two major things that we're going to survey this morning briefly. So first of all, the apocalyptic writings. So there's a number of apocalyptic writings from this period. Many of them are in the body of literature that we studied earlier called the Pseudepigrapha. So we'll just run through a couple of these that have some interesting messianic ideas. The first one is the Psalms of Solomon, which was one of the writings in the Pseudepigrapha that we talked about. This psalm prays for a Davidic prince to overthrow the Romans. So you have a Davidic prince. What you're going to see here is we have our concept of Messiah from the New Testament and because the Messiah has come already. And we talk about him as prophet, priest, and king. And what we'll find is some of these strands and ideas leading up to the New Testament arose during the intertestamental period, but not necessarily wholly connected the way it's all connected for us looking back on what happened. So just to kind of set it up, that's kind of what you're going to find here. So in the Psalm of Solomon, for instance, we find a Davidic prince, a prayer for a Davidic prince to overthrow the Romans. So you can see there, that's the king part of Messiah. A Davidic prince just means someone from the line of David who would be in the royal lineage. And you also see there the idea of overthrowing the Romans. So you have there sort of this conquering kingly figure that was expected. The second writing is the Testament of the 12 Patriarchs. Again, this is one of those books in the Pseudepigrapha that we mentioned earlier. This one is interesting because it refers to two different types of a Messiah. The Testament of the 12 Patriarchs is divided into 12 books, really, one for each patriarch. And so in two of the books, Reuben and Levi, we find the idea of a priestly figure. And then in one of the books, you can maybe guess which one, Judah, we find the idea of a kingly Davidic figure. So you see in the Testament of the 12 Patriarchs, you see these two different ideas, one of a priestly and one of a kingly Messiah. In another document, which is referred to as the Damascus Zadokite Fragments, we have a Messiah from Aaron, from Aaron's line. And so that would be tied to the priestly side, then a priestly Messiah. And then in the book of Enoch, which is also in the Pseudepigrapha, and we talked a little bit about Enoch earlier because Enoch is very interesting because it uses many terms that are applied to a coming Messiah that are picked up on by some of the New Testament writers. And we talked before, this is also the book that's quoted in Jude. So Enoch uses several terms that are applied to a coming Messiah. Anointed is the word for Messiah. That's what it means. righteous one, elect one, and son of man. So you see a lot of different terms applied to a coming Messiah there. And we talked about some of those and how the New Testament writers pick up on those terms in the New Testament writing. Now, the other thing that's a related theme related to Messiah is the expectation of a coming kingdom. And this is viewed in different ways. Maybe now's a good time to say that there aren't any monolithic ideas out there about Messiah or what the kingdom will look like. It's a very mixed bag. So you don't read these writings and come up with a very clear understanding of what was expected. There wasn't a uniformity of expectations, maybe is another way to say that. There were a lot of different kinds of ideas. So for the coming of the kingdom, it's viewed in different ways. One way it's viewed is, when I say viewed, in some of the writings that we have, it's either a restoration of the Jews in a coming kingdom, or other ideas are that it's going to include all the true worshipers of God from all the nations. And so those are two different kind of ideas that we find about what the kingdom is going to be like. And it's often described as a rule of God on earth for some definite period of time, then followed by an eternal kingdom. And then it's conceived of as a glorious kingdom where evil is eradicated. So we find both these messianic ideas in the writings as well as these ideas about what the coming kingdom will be like. And then turning to the second major source I'd like to just speak briefly about is the writings that are directly related to the Qumran community. And we talked about Qumran earlier also and what those folks believed and some of their characteristics. But here we'll just pick out some of the things that we learn about their ideas about a coming Messiah. And so this knowledge is coming from the Dead Sea Scrolls. And they really give us a snapshot in time as to what this particular community believed at that particular time in history. So it kind of gives us a snapshot of one community's ideas. So there were fragments, along with all the other literature and scrolls that were found, biblical scrolls at Qumran and the Dead Sea Scrolls, mixed in there were fragments of apocalyptic literature, and we see an interest in these types of themes, as well as a strong expectation of a coming messianic figure, maybe stronger than anywhere else we see it in the Qumran community. So they had an expectation of a coming messianic son of David, and possibly from their own ranks. So there's some clues that they expected a messianic figure to arise from their own community. Actually, F.F. Bruce has a really good chapter on this in Second Thoughts on the Dead Sea Scrolls. There's a chapter called The Messianic Hope that's related to the Qumran community. So it's a very good chapter. I'm kind of borrowing some of his ideas here, but mixing in some others, which you'll see in a moment. So what we find in these writings is that the Messiah would be from David's line. And we talked earlier about how Qumran had this idea about this cosmic battle between the forces of light and the forces of darkness. And you see that here in this. There's the Messiah would be coming from David's line and would lead the sons of light to victory over the sons of darkness in the last days. And then that cosmic conflict would usher in the new age. There's some interesting speculation about what they thought of the Messiah. So F.F. Bruce, who's one of the leading scholars of this period, says that there's evidence that their expectation of a Messiah included this idea of a threefold Messiah, prophet, priest, and king, that we know well looking back on everything. But if they did have that idea, it was most likely viewed as three separate figures, so not unified in a single figure. There's a lot of debate about these ideas, by the way. I'm giving you a very simplistic snapshot of this. There's another scholar that I've quoted often in this course by the name of D.S. Russell, and he states that according to the Manual of Discipline, which is one of the major writings from Qumran, two messiahs were expected, one from the Aaronic line, which would be the priestly side, and one from Israel, which would be the kingly side. So even among these scholars, you can see there's a disagreement in interpretation of the writings on whether there's a threefold or a twofold type of Messiah. And so why is that? Why isn't it clear? Well, the writings are very difficult to interpret. It's sometimes really hard to tell what exactly they meant when they're writing. It's not like somebody writing a book today that would be very clearly explaining these ideas. So we're trying to kind of piece together the ideas from the limited writings that we have. Another very interesting thing that F.F. Bruce points out is that he finds some evidence that they recognized an essential identity between the Son of Man in Daniel, who was a person coming in judgment, a figure coming in judgment, and the suffering servant of Isaiah. So this is another question that comes up. How is the Son of Man related to the suffering servant? How is the Son of Man related to Messiah? How is the Messiah related to suffering servant? You have all these ideas that we sort of take for granted because they're all unified in Christ. But here we're trying to understand what the thinking would have been when Jesus came on the scene. So maybe it would be helpful to actually read a couple verses from Daniel. This is from Daniel chapter 7. This is the Son of Man passage. Daniel chapter 7, verses 13 and 14 says this: "In my vision at night I looked, and there before me was one like a Son of Man, coming with the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days and was led into his presence. He was given authority, glory, and sovereign power. All peoples, nations, and men of every language worshipped him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away, and his kingdom is one that will never be destroyed." And this is in the context, by the way, that what's just gone before in Daniel chapter 7 is the conquest of the beasts and God's conquest over the spirit of the age and the powers of the age. And so then this transcendent figure, the Son of Man, is viewed in a vision by Daniel. And this is the quotation that Jesus uses when he's under interrogation by Caiaphas in the New Testament, you might remember. "Like a Son of Man coming with the clouds of heaven." The Son of Man is a conquering figure in Daniel. And is that somehow related to the suffering servant in the ideas here of Qumran? This is another one of those things that's hotly debated. It's not clear. If the Qumran community did recognize this identity, it would be very remarkable because we don't find that anywhere else. The concept of a suffering Messiah was really a foreign concept to most of the Jews of the day. So Jesus, of course, brings all of these ideas together in his person. His life and work really challenged the popular idea that the Messiah would be a king who would come to conquer the enemies of the Jews and set up a kingdom by force, you know, liberating them from the Romans and setting up an earthly kingdom by force. And we'll talk more about that in just a minute when we kind of try to put all these ideas together. If there's a threefold or a twofold Messiah idea in Qumran, the expectation was that they would come in the lifetime of the Qumran community. They actually talk about it being 40 years after the death of the Teacher of Righteousness. There's a lot of debate, you might guess, on who the Teacher of Righteousness is also. So these are lots of unknowns here. But definitely there seemed to be an expectation that they were living in the last days and the messianic figure would arise during their generation or the subsequent generation. Okay, so that's the source material that's available. Now we'll try to put this together and just say, what does it mean? Any questions about any of that before I tackle that? Okay, so what if we put this all together, what are the conceptions then? Again, this is a very simplistic summary of a complex topic, so it might not be exactly right in every instance here. So we definitely see priestly and kingly Messiah figures in the source literature, possibly prophetic as well, but probably conceived as separate individuals, not necessarily unified in a single individual. The idea of an earthly messianic rule appears in these writings. This would be similar to the literal view of the millennium in Revelation, where there's going to be an earthly kingdom set up before the big ending, okay? So if you're familiar with that view of the millennium from Revelation chapter 20, these ideas would be similar to that, looking for a messianic rule. So there's three different sources that talk about this. Second Enoch talks about a 1,000-year messianic rule. 2 Esdras is another book that we've mentioned before. It looks for a 400-year rule. And then 2 Baruch looks for an indefinite period, an earthly rule, but they don't specify the period of time. So there's two different strands of thought when you look at messianic ideas in the intertestamental period. One is this idea of an earthly kingdom being set up. And then there's more of an eschatological Messiah idea that would be more of a futuristic, eternal kingdom that would be set up. So you see both of these ideas. Some of the questions that are raised are, what is the relation of the Messiah to the Son of Man? D.S. Russell has an excellent chapter on this in his book called Between the Testaments. There's references to the Son of Man. We mentioned one of them already in 1 Enoch, also in 2 Esdras. And he sees these as probably an imaginative development of the Son of Man idea in Daniel that we read. So picking up on that idea that's found in Daniel and imagining what it would be like. There's a lot of debate on how the Son of Man is related to the Messiah in these writings. 2 Esdras is one of the books that we talked about. That's actually a post-Christian book that was written, I forget when, but around 100 AD, I think. They do seem to refer to the same figure in that writing. But, you know, it's written pretty late, so it's hard to tell what kind of influence would have been there for 2 Esdras. D.S. Russell sees the Son of Man more as a transcendent figure as opposed to this idea of an earthly king, an earthly Messiah. In other words, the Messiah idea would be looking more at that earthly reign and earthly kingdom, but the Son of Man is more of a transcendent figure that would relate to the eschaton and to the last days. So what can we make of this to sum this up? We definitely see a rise in messianic expectations during the intertestamental period. The Messiah is often viewed, though, in a one-dimensional way, either as a priestly or a kingly figure, most likely. I mentioned this a minute ago. We see both the earthly and the future eschatological concepts described. There's this scholar by the name of Lasore who has an article, I believe this is from the ISBE, some people might have that, the Bible Encyclopedia, 4-volume set. His article on the Dead Sea Scrolls says this, "The concept of the Messiah, though rooted in the Old Testament, took its New Testament form in the intertestamental period." So you hear what he's saying there? The idea of Messiah is rooted in the Old Testament, but the form that it took when we open the pages of the New Testament was fleshed out during the intertestamental period. And it might be surprising to us, again, looking back on all of this, that the term Messiah is not clearly used in the Old Testament to refer to a coming son of David. To us, that seems kind of obvious when we read the Old Testament now. But, you know, when you look at the way Mashiach is used in the Old Testament, which means, again, anointed, some of you know examples of that. It's often used of priests. The priests are anointed. It usually refers to a king, the Lord's anointed. You know, David is a good example. If you look through the ways that it's used, the majority of them are used in a kingly sense, the Lord's anointed. You find that a lot in the Psalms, for instance. And then it's even used of Cyrus. Cyrus is called the Lord's anointed who is going to come and free the Jews. So there is one passage in Daniel chapter 9, 25 and 26 that talks about the coming prince. And that seems to be a little more closely related to a coming son of David related to the Messiah figure. Possibly some of the Psalms have that connotation also if you look at some of the uses in the Psalms. But at any rate, by the time of Jesus, Messiah had a well-defined meaning. And these ideas of what that was developed during the intertestamental period. So then when we open the pages of the New Testament, the people clearly have some ideas in their mind of what the Messiah is. It might not have been exactly right, but they were definitely expecting a Messiah figure. So then when we see Jesus and John the Baptist even coming on the scene, the Jews could ask them, "Are you the Messiah?" And let's take a quick look at some of those passages. Matthew 26, 63, just read a couple verses here. These passages will be familiar. This is during Jesus' trial now, okay? So what happened there in Matthew 26? "The high priest said to him, 'I charge you under oath by the living God, tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God.' And Jesus replies, 'Yes, it is as you say.'" But the fact is, he's looking for the Messiah. Are you the Messiah? So the idea of a coming Messiah was present there, even with the high priest. Another example is in John chapter 1. John chapter 1, verse 20. Now, this is John the Baptist. I'll start in verse 19. Now, this was John's testimony when the Jews of Jerusalem sent priests and Levites to ask him who he was. He did not fail to confess, but confessed freely, "I am not the Christ." Okay, so you see that they're asking him, "Are you the Messiah?" And he's confessing, "I am not the Christ." And then in verse 24, now some Pharisees who had been sent questioned him, "Why then do you baptize if you are not the Christ, nor Elijah, nor the prophet?" So you see, they have this idea of Messiah in their mind, and they're wondering, John the Baptist, are you the coming Messiah? And then they ask Jesus in his trial, "Are you the Messiah?" And so those ideas were very present at this time. There was a big expectation of a coming messianic figure. So summing up the characteristics of the messianic figure, this is D.S. Russell. He says, at the beginning of the Christian era, the vast majority of the Jews shared the belief in the coming of a mighty warrior Messiah of David's line. So we might say that the kingly Messiah figure was the dominant understanding, and the Jews likely had no concept of a union between the kingly figure and the suffering servant of Isaiah that we now take for granted. Russell actually argues, actually he's not the only one, I think a lot of people argue, that this popular conception of a Messiah as a conquering king, political figure who's going to free them from the Romans, may have been one of the reasons why Jesus discouraged the use of that title for himself and preferred the title Son of Man instead. Remember what I said earlier from D.S. Russell, the Son of Man is a more transcendent figure as opposed to an earthly king. So the Messiah, if they're expecting an earthly, kingly Messiah figure to free them from the Romans, one of the reasons he may have preferred the term Son of Man is to distance himself from that idea. So let me close this section by reading a lengthy quote from D.S. Russell, which I think sums up these ideas very well. This is from his little book, Between the Testaments. This is an excellent book if you are interested in further study. This is from a section, well, the chapter is the Messiah and the Son of Man. So he's looking at the connection between the Messiah and the Son of Man. But he has a section here on Jesus. So he says here, picking up on that idea that Jesus was probably discouraging the use of the title Messiah because of this earthly connotation. He says, small wonder that Jesus, from the time of his temptation onwards, not only refused to proclaim himself Messiah, but discouraged others from using the title of him. He knew himself to be such, and later his disciples knew also. But not until near the end of his life, when he stood before the high priest, did he acknowledge openly his messiahship. To have done so earlier would have led to complete misunderstanding, not only on the part of the people, but even on the part of his own disciples. You can think of some of the impetuousness of the disciples wanting to take the kingdom now also. There's several examples of that. Picking up again on the quotation, how different was his interpretation from that of the people of his day? Not for him the role of the mighty warrior gaining his kingdom by bloodshed and war. His kingdom would not come by taking life, but by giving it. At Caesarea Philippi, in reply to Peter's words, "Thou art the Messiah," he made it clear that his messiahship would be fulfilled only in terms of the suffering servant who would give his life a ransom for many. Such a correlation of these ideas was something new in Judaism. True, suffering servant and kingly messiah may have had common roots in the royal cultic rites as reflected, for example, in the Psalter, as scholars have suggested. But as H.H. Rowley remarks, quote, there is no serious evidence of the bringing together of the concepts of the suffering servant and the Davidic Messiah before the Christian era. The two concepts were brought together in the thought and teaching of Jesus, end quote. Here was a divine imperative from which he could not shrink. Jesus did not believe himself to be the Messiah, although he had to suffer. He believed himself to be the Messiah because he had to suffer. This message of a crucified Messiah was to the Jews a stumbling block and to the Gentiles foolishness, but to those who are called it was the power and the wisdom of God. 1 Corinthians 1:23 and following. So I thought that summed up both the ideas at the time as well as the work that Jesus actually did as Messiah. So that's all I have on that material. Any questions or comments? Yes, Ginny. Right. Yeah, that's a good example. It's after the feeding of the 5,000 that the people came and wanted to make him king. I can think of a couple instances where they wanted to make him king. And we certainly see that tendency in the disciples in several cases, too. Yes, Charlie. So the question is, do modern-day Jews attribute any of the Messiah ideas to Jesus, or is it still forward-facing? To my knowledge, they don't. They completely reject Jesus as the Messiah. So on what basis, I really don't know, other than the spiritual basis, which, of course, is obvious. So I don't really know what they're looking for today as well. Pastor? That's probably worthwhile for me to try to sum up. Pastor just commented that the modern-day Jew is not monolithic either. There's multiple levels. There's at least four different schools of Jews. And I had forgotten that many of the Jews, just like Protestants, don't know their Bibles. There's actually an excellent seminar I've heard on this that was put on by Westminster Seminary, I think. Really, that was the one thing that hammered home to me is, just like Protestants, the majority of them don't even know the Bible. So it's more cultural. But the ones that do follow the scriptures carefully most likely reject, actually go to arguments to reject the idea of a suffering Messiah, which will be attached to Jesus. Yes, Daniel. A good point, Daniel. When you were talking about, I was thinking of the passage from Isaiah that's quoted in the New Testament that these people will be ever seeing but not believing. So the spiritual dimension there is, and part of God's sovereign plan is definitely, you know, the cause of all of this. And also, excellent point about, probably should mention that there are Messianic Jews that are Christians that have accepted Jesus as the Messiah. I've actually been to some of their meetings in Jerusalem. And it's a little strange for us because they still have the cultural remnants. I think when I was there, it was some kind of Passover meal that I was there for. So it's a little strange to us, but I think there's cultural carryover there. The cultural part of it is carried over. But they do believe in Jesus as a Messiah. I know it's very confusing and that it gets a little bit weird, but hopefully that looking at this quick survey and trying to sum it up like this will help you when you read the New Testament now to explain some of the reactions that people had to Jesus. Yes, Dave. Yeah, the question. Yeah, that's a good question. Would the Sadducees and Pharisees have a different expectation of a Messiah? I don't really know about that. I mean, you've got Caiaphas, who would have been from the Sadducee party, is the one that's asking Jesus, are you the Messiah? But he's doing that in a court sort of sense. The Pharisees, I would think, they're more conservative. They're more looking for the kingdom and things like that. The Sadducees were very politically minded and aligned with Rome and did not want to disturb the peace. So my speculation would be that they wouldn't be necessarily looking as much for a coming figure to throw off the shackles of Rome like maybe the Pharisees would have been looking for. Yes, Ginny. Right, that's possible. That's a good comment. If the Sadducees only accepted the Torah, a lot of the Messianic ideas aren't in the Torah, so that's a good point. That's actually a highly debated point also. We're going to talk about that when we get to the Pharisees and Sadducees in a few weeks, but I think that's based on a misreading of Josephus, is my personal opinion. Right, yep, that's one of the interchanges that's used to support that idea. That interpretation of what Josephus says about the Sadducees. But we can talk about that in a few weeks when we get to that. It's a good thought. Anything else? This isn't really related. It's not really in the intertestamental period, but I wanted to make everyone aware of what happens afterwards. We're kind of done with the history part. We looked at these two ideas, you know, what happened with the synagogue development and the messianic expectations. And really now we're going to turn to opening the New Testament era and the context that we find in the New Testament. That's the last major section that we're going to go into. So we're not really going to get back to history. So before we did that, I wanted to just bring to your attention that there were later Jewish revolts that are sometimes figure into this. And so I thought maybe just to familiarize us, I could just briefly mention these revolts. many of you are aware of these already, but there was a first Jewish revolt against the Romans that began in AD 66. And this is the revolt that led to the destruction of the temple by the Romans. Josephus, incidentally, was an eyewitness to that revolt. He was actually a military commander on the side of the Jews during that revolt. So his book, The Wars of the Jews, is a primary source for this and is considered very accurate. But the first revolt began in AD 66, and then that led to the capture of Jerusalem in AD 7 and the destruction of the temple. And the Roman generals at the time that participated in putting down the revolt were Vespasian and his son Titus, who both, incidentally, were future emperors. But they systematically put down the rebellion. Titus was the one who actually conquered Jerusalem. Then we have the Ark of Titus celebrating his victory. This, incidentally, is also possibly when the Dead Sea Scrolls were hidden away. There's a lot of speculation that that is when the scrolls were carefully packed in the jars and hid away in the caves of Qumran during this period, because the Romans put down the revolt in Jerusalem, but then there were holdouts out in the desert that they had to deal with later in the Qumran area. Jesus, of course, had predicted the destruction of the temple. Remember, he says in Matthew 24, not one stone will be standing on another. And there's also passages in Luke that talk about this. So that happened in AD 70, and isolated resistance continued to be put down in the villages and over towards the Dead Sea, which is where Qumran was located, which is some other reason why it's possible or maybe even probable that that is when the Dead Sea Scrolls were hidden away. And then that ended in the conquest of Masada, which was the last stronghold that held out. That was finally conquered in AD 73. That's a spectacular site, too, by the way, if you ever have a chance to go to Israel. Try to go to Masada. It's quite amazing. You can still see the remains of the Roman camps down at the base of it. But it's a high mountain that's like sheer cliffs all the way around. And the Romans built this enormous ramp. I mean, enormous ramp up that finally ended in the conquest that took years. Anyways, that's interesting history. Then there was another revolt later. It's called the Bar Kokhba Revolt. This happened in AD 132 to 135, so quite a bit later. And this revolt was resistance to paganism under Emperor Hadrian. And it led to the second revolt led by Simeon Bar Kokhba with support of the Sanhedrin. And this revolt was also put down, and this was really the last major rebellion that we know of from the Jews against the Romans in the Palestine area. You know, you might have some of those questions about when was the temple destroyed, what were the Romans doing, and things like that. So just keep in mind that after our period ends here, into the New Testament period, then there were these subsequent Jewish revolts.